Good morning. My name's Austin. I'm the pastor here at Rosewood Church. It's good to have you here today. And I'll tell you what, it's so good to have all of you here today. It's good to see new faces every Sunday. And if this is your first Sunday, or maybe it's been a while, we are really happy that you're here. We hope that you find this to be a place where you can grow in your faith. And again, if this is your first Sunday, consider giving us 3 Sundays here at Rosewood. It's hard to tell about a church, any church, in just 1 or 2 visits. And for those of you who have been here, in order to make space for the new faces that are here, one thing that you can do to help, in addition to being incredibly friendly people as you are, we can do something that a lot of you aren't going to like. You can peel off that invisible name tag that you have on your seat. And if you would consider moving forward a little bit when you sit, and also even to slide into the rows as you come in order to help someone who is new find a place to sit and not know where to go. So thank you for your cooperation, and thank you for caring for new people like me at this church. But anyway, moving on. Have you ever thought to yourself, what did I do to deserve this? Is that a question that you've ever asked yourself? What did I do to deserve this? What did I do in a past life? What did I do yesterday? What have I done to deserve what I have now? And this happens to me all the time. Personally, I think this all the time. What did I do to deserve this? And even when I was a kid, I kind of laugh at how I was when I was a little kid. I asked that all the time. That's how I understood why things happen in this world. It's because of what we do. And it's black and white like that. If bad things happen to me, it's because I did something bad. And so then I would put myself in these positions where, have you guys ever like tried to make a deal with God, like cut a deal with him? Where like if he'll help you find something, or if he'll help you understand something, or if he'll make it so that your parents don't find out, that if you do something like that, if he were to act in that way, you will do in return something for him. I wonder if there are missionaries overseas who are there simply because they made a deal with God. God delivered, and they're like, now I gotta go. I don't know. There might even be pastors like that. But I remember when I was a kid, I lost a necklace. I had a gold chain necklace with a gold cross on it. That like basically for a kid, it took me a lifetime to have enough money to buy that. And then I was playing basketball, and somehow it got torn off, and I didn't know where it went, so I searched everywhere for it. And the whole time, I'm just making like deals with God. Like, if you show me where it is, I'll do this or that. I probably said, if you show me, I'll become a pastor or whatever, and then now I'm here. But the point is, I think about that, and I kind of laugh to myself on how I make deals, and sometimes still today, I think, what did I do to deserve it? And but other times, it's not so fun. When terrible things happen that rock your world or your family or your community, it's natural to ask, why me? What did I do to deserve this? As if you earned your trials because of some kind of evil that occurred that you did. And I wouldn't be surprised if you've been there, because it's natural. It's incorrect, but it is natural. Now, we've been in Job, the book of Job, for a few weeks now, and if you've been here for the entire series, one of the things that I hope that you've gleaned is that no matter how faithful you are to Jesus, no matter how devoted you are, it does not mean that you are entitled to a pain-free, trial-free life. Trials have and will happen to you, which is why it's especially important to remember this, that your life is more affected by the ways you respond to trials than the trials themselves. And thankfully, Jesus and the authors of the Bible had a lot to say about the vision frame of circumstances, the way that we should approach these things, because again, it's not a question of if, it's a question of when. Now, we're 3 weeks into a 4-week series that looks at the tragic book and life of Job. And in each of the last 2 messages, I've mentioned Job's friends. After the man of God, Job, who the story is named after. After Job has his entire fortune, he's a rich man, but his fortune goes away. He's a healthy man, but his health goes away. He has a wonderful family, but unfortunately his family dies. That after all these things happen, his friends gather around him. And at first, they did what they should do. It says, the story says that they sat with him just quietly for a week. But then they opened their big mouths. And they thought that his pain, these trials, were a result of past, unreconciled, unrepentant sin. Now, we've been kind of hard on these three friends, and but they are not meant to be the good guys. They believe that God works in black and white ways, where he punishes bad deeds, and Job appears to be punished by the hand of God. Thus, it must be logically that Job has done something horrible to offend God. But let's hear them out for a minute. They were wrong, as the story tells us. But I would argue that they believe themselves to be delivering real truth to Job. And here's why. First, we need to remember what happened specifically to Job. So I'm going to read it. It's not going to be on the screens, but I'm going to read it to you. And then at the end, you're going to get basically a bulleted version of what I read. And I'm reading from Job chapter 1, verses 14 to 19. Then I'm going to skip ahead to chapter 2, verse 7. So here's what it says. A messenger, that's one of Job's servants, came to Job and said, "The oxen were plowing and the donkeys were grazing nearby, and the Sabaeans attacked and made off with them." Sabaeans are a foreign power. "They put the servants to the sword, and I am the only one who escaped to tell you." While he was still speaking, another messenger came and said, "The fire of God fell from the heavens and burned up the sheep and the servants, and I am the only one who escaped to tell you." While he was still speaking, another messenger came. "The Chaldeans," another foreign power, "the Chaldeans formed three raiding parties and swept down on your camels and made off with them. They put the servants to the sword, and I am the only one who escaped to tell you." While he was still speaking, yet another messenger came and said, "Your sons and daughters were feasting and drinking wine at the oldest brother's house, when suddenly a mighty wind swept in from the desert and struck down the four corners of the house. It collapsed on them, and they are dead. And I am the only one who has escaped to tell you." Then, later on, "Satan went out from the presence of the Lord and afflicted Job with painful sores, from the soles of his feet to the crown of his head." So that's a lot to take in. Here's a bulleted version of what I just read. His camel, all of his animals were stolen by a foreign power. His servants were killed. Fire ravaged his sheep and they died. Sons and daughters die when the house collapses, and sores form on his body from head to toe. So, in Job's friend's defense, let's consider Deuteronomy chapter 28. Now, this is an important chapter in the Hebrew Bible for Jews. And in chapter 28, the first 14 verses, and this is very important for in terms of Jewish culture and Jewish religion, that the first 14 verses are the blessings that if the nation of Israel would bless God, would honor him, honor his name, worship him, follow the laws, if they do that, these are the ways that God will bless them. But then conversely, the last 54 verses are all of the ways that if they curse God, if they go astray, if they forget him, if they do things the wrong way, that these are the curses that God will bring upon them. And God made a covenant with this nation, and the terms are that if they're faithful to him, he will uphold them as the chosen nation above all other nations and bless them. And Deuteronomy 28 kind of brings the benefits and the curses of upholding that covenant. Now, I'm going to read one portion of these curses from Deuteronomy 28. And I'm going to read specifically verses 31 to 35. And as I do, I want you to keep an eye on the screen behind me of what we read in Job. Now remember, Deuteronomy 28, these are words that Job and his friends would have known. In fact, many in the Jewish culture would have had this memorized. So they know what Deuteronomy 28 says. Now compare that to the experience of Job that you see behind me. So here's what Deuteronomy says. Your ox will be slaughtered before your eyes, but you will eat none of it. Your donkey will be forcefully taken from you and will not be returned. Your sheep will be given to your enemies and no one will rescue them. Your sons and daughters will be given to another nation and you will wear out your eyes watching for them day after day, powerless to lift a hand. A people that you do not know will eat what your land and labor produce. You will have nothing but cruel oppression all your days. The sights you see will drive you mad. The Lord will afflict your knees and legs with painful boils that cannot be cured, spreading from the soles of your feet to the top of your head. Now these three friends thought that Job had done evil. Why? Because Job's curses really match so closely to Deuteronomy 28 and the curses listed that are the result of being unfaithful. And what we're talking about here is a theological term called retributive theology. So remember this phrase when you need to sound smart in a crowd. Retributive theology. It means basically that you reap what you sow from God. If you are a good person, according to God's standards, then you will be blessed with good things. But if you do bad things, according to God's standards, God will make bad things happen to you. It's very black and white. It's almost predictable. You know exactly what's going to happen. And I say all this because retributive theology is a way of making sense of your pains and trials. And so many people buy into retributive theology as their basis for understanding their faith and why things are happening to them. If you adhere to this belief, then your trials only make sense by looking backwards. Because every trial in your life, every pain in your life, every suffering in your life is a result of something that you did to bring this upon you. Something that you did is being equally measured against you. So why are things happening to you? Look backwards. How do you make sense of your present circumstances? Look at your past. Where is the purpose in your pain? Look backwards. Job's friends worked so hard to get Job to look backwards and to search his memory and confess whatever terrible things, absolutely horrible things he must have done to bring on the entire wrath of God. And so many followers of Jesus today maintain this viewpoint. For some of you, even this is how you're trying to make sense of your pain and your trials. You're trying to make sense of your life today, what you're experiencing now, by thinking, what did I do to deserve this? In fact, for some of you, this is why, deep down, you try to obey God to the best of your ability anyway. Because you think that there's a God up in heaven that's basically cocked back with a lightning bolt ready to hit you if you make the wrong step. Your obedience is actually established in a fear of this retributive God rather than the joy of a forgiving God that rather than giving you what you deserve, chose to actually die for you in your place. And in John 9, Jesus is confronted, the Gospel of John, skipping ahead 2,000 years here, Jesus is confronted with this retributive viewpoint that was so pervasive still in Jewish culture. And I would say still pervasive in Christian culture today. And this is what it says, the beginning of John 9. As Jesus went along, he saw a man blind from birth. His disciples asked him, Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind? All right, cultural context time. in the first century, Pharisees, those who were the Jewish religious leaders in Jesus' day, believed there was a connection between present disabilities and past sin. And that's why the question that the Jesus' disciples ask is, who sinned this man or his parents? Not did his parents or he or his parents sin, but rather who did? Because clearly, from their viewpoint, there has been sin. So the question is just, who did it? And in this interaction, the topic is disabilities. But the mindset was much broader than disabilities. Anything that was identified in that day as sinful, painful, or even just difficult, like blindness, was immediately linked to the past. And in some cases, linked even further back than the person that it was affected by. They would go back to the parents or the ancestors. If that's the case, if that's the reason for your pain or your trials, what are you going to do about it? Well, what's the reason for that? And so Jesus responds by saying this, neither this man nor his parents sinned, said Jesus, but this happened so that the works of God might be displayed in him. Go, Jesus said to him, wash in the pool of Siloam. So the man went and washed and came home seeing. Jesus totally denies the traditionally held retributive mindset that this man's trials or pain or his difficulties were the result of the past. And instead of looking backwards, he points the purpose of this man's pain, this man's trials, this, you know, whatever's happening to this man, instead of looking backwards, he points it to the future. Now, as the story continues of this man, he's healed, and then rumor starts to go around. I think as it would anywhere, frankly, in any small town, if there's someone who's blind and you're kind of in your sphere of influence that you know, and suddenly he's seeing, probably gonna make news. And it does. And people start talking about this man who everyone knew was blind, but now he's not. And so they go to him, the Pharisees go to him and say, what's happening here? And he says, well, Jesus healed me. Now the Pharisees got very mad. Why? Because Jesus did it on the Sabbath. Uh-oh. Can't heal on the Sabbath like that. And so they go to him and they say, you know, tell us more. Who is this man? In fact, he delivers, if you read John 9, he delivers one of the snarkiest responses in the entire Bible, in my opinion. He says, oh, do you want to hear the story again because you want to believe too? And so they keep saying, tell us what's going on. And this man says, look, I don't know. All I know is that I was blind and now I can see. And so eventually this man finds Jesus again and he puts his faith in Jesus. He makes a faith commitment to Jesus because of the miracle that he worked in his life. And just think of the legacy of this man's difficulties. His life has become a miracle that has inspired over 1 billion people to put their faith and their hope in Jesus. And as Jesus predicted, this happened to him so that the works of God would be displayed. It wasn't because he did what he did or what his parents did in the past. It was so that the Son of God could be announced to the world. When you face pain, suffering, and trials, don't ask, what have I done to deserve this? As if somehow you can find the answer by looking behind you. Instead, ask Jesus, what are you trying to do through my trial? What glory are you looking to bring? Why are you trying to get my attention? Because that's the thing about pain. It is a real attention getter. When I was a kid, I lived a very destructive life. And I don't mean that in like the destructive sin way. I mean like I got hurt a lot. And at one point, this isn't in the notes, doesn't matter, I'm just, whatever. At one point, in 2 years, I broke somewhere between like 20 and 24 bones. I had stitches a few times. I had one surgery. At the time, all I did was ride dirt bikes, motorcycles, and skateboards. It was the best 2 years of my life. But I got hurt a lot, and there was one time where it was the second time I broke my ring finger. I broke it, I had a splint on it, and then something hit it or something fell on it, and I broke the splint and my finger again. So now it's been broken three times, but twice at the same time. And so they put a new splint on it, and this time they put a cast on it this time. So I can't take it off or see what's going on, and I start to feel a lot of pain in my finger. So I go in and they take a look and they say, it looks fine. It's red, but we'd expect that. And it hurts more and more and more. And finally I tell my parents, like, I know they said nothing's wrong, but I really think something is. And we went in and they did a biopsy and they found that I had a staph infection and some of my bone had already deteriorated out of my finger. And normally you could know it was a staph infection just by even looking at the skin. But the pain told me a different story than what we could see on my finger. See, without pain, I wouldn't have known that the bone was starting to deteriorate out of my finger. Without pain, you and I would keep re-injuring ourselves or even ignoring problems that could kill us. A couple months ago, I had a friend who he had a pain in his body, in a certain place on his body, and it hurt and it hurt and it hurt. And he kept saying, no, I don't need to do anything about it. And finally, his wife, you know, finally pestered him to say, you've got to go in. And he found that he had cancer. And now they're treating it and they're hopeful that they can in fact cure his cancer. But had he kept waiting and ignoring that pain as much as he could, who knows what would have happened. And in your spiritual life, you can ignore your Bible. You can ignore prayer. You can ignore worship. You can ignore giving. You can ignore singing. You can ignore being together like this. You can ignore just about anything, but you can't ignore pain. My prayer for you is not that you will live a pain-free life, but that you'll learn to discern the voice of God in your pain and ask, what future glory is God trying to bring in a way that can only be cultivated through pain? Now, doesn't that sound a lot different from the disciples' reaction to the man that they came across? Doesn't that sound a lot different from Job's friends who were trying to supposedly comfort Job? Maybe that sounds a lot different from the way that you're interpreting pain as well. If so, let's move ahead. Pain and trials serve a future purpose, and a lot of times we don't see that purpose when we're in it, right? Only after we've weathered the storm can we see God's hand in our circumstances. Pain serves a future purpose in a way that nothing else can, which is why when pain comes, don't try to go around it. You see, we can sometimes try so hard to get out of pain that we don't actually get anything out of pain. Christian circles sometimes refer to life's ups and downs as valleys and mountaintops. If you're in a valley, it means that life is very difficult. You're in tough times. But if you're on a mountaintop, it means that times are great. And generally, we hope to spend a little bit more time on the mountaintop than we do in the valley. And when you enter a trial in your life or a valley, you may want to go in one of two extremes when you find yourself down there. And both extremes discredit God's purpose for your circumstances. And these two extremes, what I'm going to share with you in a second, they don't take away the pain. They just take away any purpose that you could possibly find in it. So on the one hand, many want to get out of the valley as soon as possible. And in the end, they end up denying the pain or the doubts that are undermining their life. You tell yourself, I'm going to pretend that this crisis isn't happening. Instead, if I can just get back, if I can scurry out of this valley and get back up to the mountaintops where everything felt good, where everything was just right, if I can get there as soon as possible, deny the pain, put a smile on, move on. When I started out as a pastor, I spent a lot of time trying to make people get out of the valley up onto the mountaintop as soon as possible. Because after all, isn't it better to sit and smile with someone than cry? So I tried to get people out as fast as possible. And since then, I've learned that if you're focused on getting out of your circumstances, you're not going to get anything out of your circumstances. The other extreme is that when people find themselves in the valley, they descend even further down. Now, maybe you've been here, or maybe you've been with someone who has been in this position. They just keep sliding. They say something like, okay, God, if you're not going to do what I know you can do, then forget about you. I'm going to go back to the life that I had, because if you could help me, if you could help me right now, immediately, if you could solve this as I believe that you do, and you're not, well, then I don't trust you. And I don't want anything to do with you. This extreme assumes that the only thing that we can learn from our suffering is that God is either too weak to affect your life or too uncaring to intervene. I had a friend in high school who took this extreme. I went to a church on the north side of Cedar Rapids. It was Cedar Rapids, Iowa. It was the largest church in the area. It was massive. It was about 30 minutes away from my house, and so I was 10 minutes south of Cedar Rapids where I lived, and my school was there as well, and even though I went to a very large high school, there was only four people, including myself, four people who went to Prairie High School who also went to First Assembly of God in Cedar Rapids, and so the four of us knew each other pretty well. Two of the three friends stood with me in my wedding. The third one, unfortunately, his dad passed away unexpectedly. He had a heart attack and he dropped while this friend of mine was in high school. And he never got out of the stage of blaming God. And after I left, I haven't seen him in years, but he was still there, blaming God for what happened, ran away as fast as he could. He was left with a family that had a hard time making ends meet because his dad was the only one who made money in the home. His mom had to stay home, and there were some issues there where she couldn't work either. They found themselves in a terribly difficult situation, and even as people came around them and loved them, he could not reconcile a God that would allow this much pain and still be good. Both extremes deny the future growth or purpose of God that God has in store for you in pain, suffering, and trials, which is why there must be a third option. And that third option is accepting the trials as a time to listen for God in ways that you can't hear when you're above the valley. Now, let me make an observation. I'm going to close out here with this. An observation I've seen, I know many of you have seen as well because you've told me this story. Last week I told you that I really love stories, and I've so appreciated as the stories come in of your life, of getting the chance to meet some of you in person and hear your stories, or even just over email or a phone call. But I love hearing the stories of the ways that God is working in your life. And every person who has made a faith commitment, you have a story. You have a story of the way that God, and the ways that God has intervened in your life in powerful ways and helped set you on a different track or recorrect you or teach you something that He couldn't have otherwise. And this story of your life, or this testimony as sometimes it's called, I have found that without fail, a person's greatest leap in faith comes right out of a valley. It's almost like the valley is a ramp to accelerate them ahead, to accelerate them to a higher place. But they needed that valley. It had to happen that way. And if that's you, if you've been in the valley and come out stronger, then you know what Jesus' words meant to the blind man, because you were the blind man. And now you are experiencing, and you can look back and see the future glory that God had in store for you, that you get to live in now. The ways that God made himself known in a way that only he could have orchestrated, that you look back and you say, I wouldn't choose it, but there's no way I could have done something this great on my own or imagined it this way. And for those of you who have not been led out of the valley yet, that you're still in the valley. And you're living there. You basically set up camp there. You need to know that God has amazing purposes for you too, and that your trials are a part of it. What you're going through isn't happening for no reason. And if you need to hear it again, stop looking backwards for the purpose. Keep looking ahead. Jesus, we come to you in prayer, each of us in our own place in life, really. Some of us perched on top of mountaintops, enjoying this good life, enjoying answered prayers and your love and your just obvious involvement in our life. For others here, we are in the valley and we're struggling. God, we together as a church, we come along together in prayer beside all of those who are in the valley, who are just struggling to hold on, to keep it together, to figure out what's going on, to figure out, to reconcile a good God with horrible circumstances. Jesus, for those of us on the mountaintop, we call out into the valley. We call out your promises and your truth and encourage those who are there. But Jesus, we also know that when we are in the valley, and when we are suffering, when we hurt, when we're in pain, God, we know that through your promises in Scripture, that through your word, that you are closer to us than you've ever been before, that you are right beside us. So God, help us to make sense of this, to understand what's happening, not to necessarily take it away like magic, but to help us get something from this so that our pain and our trials aren't just for no reason. God, build us, create us, mold us. God, we are clay in your hands. Create us to be the people that you want us to be the person that you've called us to be. God, if that requires some pain and difficulty, Jesus, we're going to trust you through it. Because we know that you work all things together for the good of those who love you. So Jesus, help us to hold on, to love you, to stay by your side, and to know that even when we don't see you, it doesn't mean that you're not there. Jesus, we love you. And we tell you that some of us with joy and smiles, and others of us through the tears. But God, we love you. In your name we pray.